Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. So, Matthew, what are we doing for this week's episode of Board Game Brothers?
Right. So this is something that I was wanting to do after seeing a discussion on the topic and thought this would be a pretty neat thing to cover on the podcast. So for one thing, we've been hyping up December as having some atypical episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this won't be a typical game discussion. Instead, the idea started because people were discussing, like, what is the new essential gateway games?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the canon of gateway games nowadays?
Right, because a lot of the games considered gateway games came out like 10 years ago or more.
Yeah, like games in like 2008, 2010, things like Ticket to Ride, Catan, those have been around for a while, but there's still been a lot of good games that are gateway game appropriate,
mm-hmm,
that have come out since then, to the point where the landscape has definitely changed. So it's worth discussing sort of what we think our canon would be in that case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end, we'll probably also mention some of what we think the essential, like, party games are, for example.
Yeah, I think party games is kind of this interesting, it's slightly overlapping, slightly a subgenre of games.
Yeah.
That has also just like boomed in popularity, you know.
It's, oh yeah, sure.
You know, ever since Apples to Apples and Cards Against Humanity, there's been so many different new, exciting, awesome, fun party games, and they kind of set aside from the type of game you can expect that a gateway game or like a hobbyist game would be. A party game is kind of its own beast with way wider appeal. So yeah, those also bear mentioning separately.
Yeah.
And I think as we're listing off and talking about games here, these might be considered good ideas for gifts if you are looking to get a fellow gamer or a potential gamer a gift this year. Then maybe you could consider what we say here in making your decision. Maybe you're shopping for someone who has never really played a serious game before. Maybe you resort to our party game suggestions for that. Or maybe you are shopping for someone who is a budding gamer who's maybe just only played Catan and you think it could be cool to get them into some other interesting games.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're shopping for a hobbyist and you just want to like maybe get like a solid essential or something.
Yeah.
Those are some ideas moving into this episode. So, Matthew, where would you like to start on our discussion on the new wave of party games, the new canon of party games? I mean, not
what
party games,
with, yeah,
gateway games.
So I think we should start with at least going over what a gateway game is really quick.
Yeah. Matthew, what is a gateway game?
A gateway game is a game that is simple enough for new players, new to the hobby and the landscape of games, to understand and play and enjoy, while also having enough depth that veterans can still enjoy them as well. They also tend to act as introductions to mechanics or concepts in games.
So much like the 7-part gateway game series at the beginning of our podcast was a gateway into our podcast, gateway games are a gateway into gaming.
Exactly.
And we've come full circle now, so
yeah,
I think the podcast
much
is over. Right before it got interesting. I also like to think of gateway games as kind of in part also being an introduction to more complicated concepts that will be expanded upon in more complicated games. And I kind of like to compartmentalize that as different mechanics and kind of consider a lot of gateway games as being a gateway into a particular mechanic that gets expanded upon or referenced often in the gaming hobby.
Right. And a lot of the games I have listed for like what I consider canon are games that fill that sort of introduction to another mechanic or another game down the line,
mm-hmm,
possibly multiple at once.
Right.
Because it's definitely worth thinking about, like, you know, if you're giving these to somebody or playing these with somebody who's completely new, then you would hope that the ones that you're playing can easier get them into the heavier ones down the line.
Right. It's a gateway game because it is both accessible right off the bat, and it has interest and value on its own, but it also, like, actually there's steps afterwards that you can follow, and there's concepts that you learn that you take along with you that will greatly improve your experience.
Exactly.
All right. Where do you want to start then?
So I want to start with, this is kind of cheating because this is one that I think we would both consider as both a gateway game and a party game,
mm-hmm.
which is Codenames.
Okay.
I think Codenames is really interesting because since it is a really good party game, but it also still has elements of like strategy and outguessing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like even maybe a step below most gateway games as a way to introduce people to gaming.
Mm-hmm.
Like if party games were for people that don't play board games, Codenames is a party game that can hint people at what some more hobbyist board games might be like.
Right. I think I follow you, in that, like, you know, I remember last year, like around this time, there was this quote-unquote game that was going around, which was just a catapult that you would put whipped cream on and set your face in a chin rest, and then that was like it. You would just, like, on your turn you'd roll a die and crank a thing, and eventually you'd get stuff in your face. There was another game that was the mouth guard game where you would draw a card and then read whatever was on the card with a mouth guard in your mouth, so it would sound differently, and maybe make you slobber all over yourself. So, and those got pretty popular with a lot of different people. And I see, you know, those games, they're not really games. There's hardly a strategy to them. Yeah, it's just kind of like an instruction on how to look foolish or have fun. Like have fun by following these easy steps.
It's a set piece.
Yeah. Whereas Codenames, I mean, that's a game through and through, and when you play it, you realize, like, there's so much more to the game than just saying, like, try to come up with a helpful clue, because you're keeping in mind a lot of different things regarding, like, the enemy team and your own team, and you have to really come up with, like, new and creative ways to approach the problems that you're faced with. There's actual strategy involved. You know, you have to plan out multiple turns ahead. For example, you could say, like, well, this clue will be better after a couple of these cards have been covered up, and the answers won't be so scattered and hard to draw from, you know. So, so you think of that clue and then you save it for later, and then you go for a more obvious clue early on just to get some words out of the way and limit confusion. Right.
But likewise, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, it can be like a huge player count per team and just like people on each team really going into what the clue might mean.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some things like the fact that you rotate spy masters. If you're already into the game, you can start a spy master and then invite another person who maybe hasn't played it that much at all to be the spy master. And then they sort of get to see from your shoes how much thought goes into that part. So by you know, offering for them to play the game in this central role, it sort of gets them to see, like, hey, this does have some amounts of strategy, which to each their own, you know. But what I mean is, like, if the rest of the gateway games on this list are step one to getting people, or like the bottom step, Codenames is the floor, like step 0.5.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'd say that's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Okay. So where do we go from Codenames?
Let's see. So I kind of have these, like I said, each one sort of going into a different category of mechanics or games.
Mm-hmm.
How about you go ahead and throw out one that you have?
Okay. So the category mechanic that I want to talk about is deck builders.
Okay.
And this is something that we talked a lot about. We've reviewed a couple of deck builder games, and
we had an episode on deck building games as a whole.
Yeah, and the game that I want to put out there as the gateway game for deck building is one that we actually haven't done an episode on, and that's Star Realms.
Mm-hmm.
So Star Realms. Now, one thing about Star Realms is it doesn't use a very common deck building mechanic, and that is cards worth points in your deck. Instead, it has direct conflict against another player. But I would argue that that might make for a more interesting gateway game, because I think just that games as a whole don't have a lot of indirect conflict, like the games that somebody who hasn't played any board games before would have been exposed to. It's all about like direct conflict and action, and Star Realms is like through and through a game about like action and direct conflict. Yeah, and
spaceships attacking your opponent's fleet and their you know, space outposts and stuff.
And when you compare it to a game where you amass cards that are worth victory points that are oftentimes don't do anything, which leads to an aspect of cutting cards from your deck being very important, that's like a key concept that you're supposed to learn from deck building. Star Realms sort of eases off of that by at least saying, like, all the cards in your deck do something. And there is potential to cut them to great effect, but your cards aren't useless in Star Realms. Every card does something, especially the cards that you start with. They all do something. And not only, I mean, in addition to all that, Star Realms is a very small game, a very cheap game.
It is only two players,
which
is hit or miss depending on, you know, who you're playing with, who you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that, like, as a loan, if you ignore the player count, it is a very good gateway deck builder.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels weird that, like, you know, to say that a two-player deck builder is the gateway experience, but I guess that's just what it is.
I mean, if there were a four-player version, I mean, I think there is a four-player variant where you just get two copies of the game.
There might be, yeah.
I just think that it's just a better leaping off point for the genre than, I mean, when we did our series, we talked about Dominion, and there's a lot of good things about Dominion, but the biggest thing is that it's huge, and there's a lot of cards, and there's a lot of information that you have to process immediately.
Right, and there's a lot of feels bad moments in Dominion.
Yeah, and Star Realms is a trade row deck builder, but a lot of deck builders are trade row deck builders.
I think Star Realms was fine in that sort of position.
Yeah, I think just based on the action that goes on in the game, and the size and the cost, you know, despite it being two. I mean, I love the game even though it's two players. I'm totally fine with that. I think it's fine to have a two player game just thrown into the mix.
Yeah.
Okay. So Star Realms is my bid for deck builder and gateway game number two.
That fits. So I want to talk about a cooperative game.
Okay.
And the cooperative gateway game title is, I think a lot of people have their own cooperative game that they think is the best gateway game.
Mm-hmm.
This is a more recent one. I think Magic Maze is the best gateway cooperative game.
Okay.
And there's a very good reason, which is Magic Maze is it's the cooperative game where you lead characters around a mall, and then they shoplift items, and then they got to leave the mall before the police catch them.
Fantasy characters, we should mention.
Yeah, right. These are like a wizard, a warrior, a thief, well, or something like that.
Yeah, kind of like a genre, a light genre mashup here.
Yeah, and I think so. Magic Maze has this whole, like, no talking aspect,
mm-hmm.
like alternative communication, where each person only has a limited number of actions they can do, whether it's moving characters in a specific direction or using escalators or stuff like that.
Well, I think in general, each player will have one cardinal direction that they can move a character in, is how I like to put it. And then in addition to that, there's the special abilities that certain players have.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, there's these unique moves or rules for what a player can do. Each player has a clearly defined role in that regard.
But the thing is that you can't talk. You can only like get somebody's attention by using like a pawn that you slam on the thing.
I think of it as a gavel.
Yeah. And yeah. Then there are spaces where when you go to them or when a character lands on them, you stop the timer that's going, but mm-hmm. you flip it over because it's a sand timer. And you can talk while time is stopped until you start back up again. But anyway, so cooperative games have traditionally had the problem of quarterbacking,
mm-hmm.
where one player directs everybody else to do their actions. And it ends up just sort of being like one player is playing the game with the other players moving the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But I think because of Magic Maze's movement limitations and discussion limitations, it helps prevent quarterbacking from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because like when I played Magic Maze, I found myself getting so used to how I can move my character that like the other three directions didn't even come to mind.
Mm.
And the frantic energy of it seems to help with that as well. So I think like it does a better job of bringing everyone into the gameplay and getting everyone engaged, even if, you know, one person's played it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think on the quarterbacking point, when I play cooperative games, sometimes I do catch myself starting to quarterback a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in this game, just to give like an example of how there might not be so much quarterbacking with that gavel, you know, you bang it in front of somebody or you tap it in front of somebody to get their attention, to let them know that you want them to use one of their abilities. And if it were a game with the license to quarterback, then if I were to play that game, I would just be banging that gavel all the time and nobody else would get a chance with it. But it just turned out that every time I played that game, with all level of skill level of players, everyone had a chance or everyone had a reason to bang the gavel at somebody, including myself. So there's it because of the communication rules in this game, there's plenty of room for people to miss something and for people to point things out to other people and for the whole thing to be a collaborative effort in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And something worth mentioning, games like Forbidden Island and Pandemic, they can be kind of tricky for really new players to understand the goal of the game,
mm-hmm.
or not like the end goal, but like what each beat to beat objective is, like what they're going for, what they should try to do. But in Magic Maze, like everyone's just moving characters to these very specific highlighted spots. So it's pretty easy to be like, bring the characters to these spaces, mm-hmm. then to these spaces.
Mm hmm.
Because like rules complexity and objective complexity can be really difficult barriers for completely new players to pass. Just like feeling lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. The rules, the object of this game is pretty basic. I mean, it's just like step one, step two, and that's the objective of the game.
And moving around a maze is, you know, as basic as it gets.
Mm-hmm. It's also, you're never thinking like, okay, what was my character supposed to do on this turn? It's always because you don't have your character. Every character belongs to you and the rest of the group. Even if you like have a pause and think like, wait, what was I supposed to be moving this guy towards? You know, other people are probably reaching for it, like move it there, move it there. And if somebody is waiting for you and, you know, they notify you with the gavel, it's not like you don't know what direction on the board you're supposed to move a character because exactly. You can only move them in one direction.
Exactly.
Yep. All right. So, gateway game number 3, cooperative game, Magic Maze.
Yeah.
Now, what should we talk about next? Should we talk about worker placement?
I couldn't. Well, so there's one good, I feel like, worker placement gateway game, but it's hard for me to like recommend to everybody.
Well, there's varying levels of complexity to gateway games and to the mechanics that you're introducing people to.
Sure,
I think worker placement just at its core is kind of a complex thing because it gives one person, the ability to do a great deal of number of things. It's like, you know, the piles in Dominion compared to the places that you can place a worker at.
Right.
And then there's the order that you have to come up with for yourself. And a lot of the times these actions that you're taking don't have a very clear, or they have a somewhat clear order to them, but you have to find the order within the order. So I can see, so a worker placement game in general is going to have more complexity than a game with just the idea of being cooperative.
Yeah.
So all that said, I think it still deserves to have a gateway game recommendation just because it's a very prevalent mechanic in a lot of games, especially some of my most favorite games are worker placement games. Maybe this is one of the games where next year there might be an even better suggestion for a worker placement game, for a gateway game.
Yeah.
But for now, I would suggest Lords of Waterdeep.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
Like, we just did an episode on it, and we mentioned that, like, after we played it with friends, like, all of our friends that played with us were like, we're going to buy that game.
Yeah, and this is kind of like a common thread with all of the gateway games that we've listed so far.
Every
time we've played it with somebody, like, the next time we hung out with them, they have their own copy. And Waterdeep is no different than that, despite it being themed after Dungeons and Dragons, which is like a less accessible theming.
And it's like heavy Dungeons and Dragons, like lore inspired.
Yeah, I mean, you think of Dungeons and Dragons and you just, exactly, it's like an actual location in like the guidebooks to the game's world that the authors created. After you play the game, you realize just how fun it is and just how simple it can be, but the deeper complexities to it are still there, being a worker placement game.
I would hate to spend a lot of time just being redundant over what we just covered last week.
Yeah.
But I will say that it does a great job of getting players to think about workers without punishing them for not thinking about workers enough.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
For more information on Lords of Waterdeep, just see our previous episode.
Yeah.
But yeah, in general, good basic worker placement. It does a lot to clearly lay out what your goal is. By having the quest cards, showing you the requirements for the quest cards, and then having the spaces where you collect those requirements.
Yeah. So, I want to, so next thing I want to bring up is drafting games.
Mm-hmm.
I have two separate games that fit within the idea of drafting.
Okay.
Which are Azul and Sushi Go.
Okay.
I think with the concept of drafting isolated, Azul is better to introduce that, but Sushi Go specifically fills the role of introducing card drafting, which is like its own subgenre.
Right. We did a whole episode on card drafting as a mechanic early on in our podcast. Yeah, but I agree with both things. Azul being in general drafting, you might call it like pool drafting, where
everybody's picking from a shared pool of objects,
mm-hmm. and you're picking from the whole pool every time.
Yeah.
It's not like in a card drafting game, you're usually drafting from a portion of the pool every time. You have a hand of cards that's being passed around, and technically all of the players will eventually get access to that hand, but you only get to pick from a portion of the pool at a given time in the form of your hand. Versus Azul, where there's a whole pool right in front of you. Everyone can see it. Everyone can size it up and figure out strategies just looking at it.
So with Sushi Go, I think the things it helps with are that, for one thing, like card drafting is a common thing, like I said, but it keeps in mind the two main parts, which are that you don't know what people are going to pass you, but you know what to pass your opponents. And it also keeps in mind that, like, a given hand can affect another hand later down the line. What mm-hmm. I mean is, like, so there's the chopsticks card in Sushi Go, which lets you draft another card in the hand and put it back in the hand that you're passing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that card alone makes it worthy of like an introduction to Seven Wonders or Seasons.
I mean, I would even argue that even more than that, it's the cards where they're poor when you have few of them, but they're extremely powerful when you have drafted a lot of them. It's like the amount of risk and reward that goes into picking a worse card so that you'll get a better card later. The chopsticks, I mean, like you said, the chopsticks kind of affect the next turn or a couple turns later, but they only really affect one more turn. But then these other cards, the pudding cups, I think, are the ones that you count at the end of the game. They have implications for the whole game. They give you reasons to think about whether you should actually pass something to somebody else. You can see what other people are drafting.
Yeah, I guess what I should say is more so like that chopsticks are a mini bump in rules complexity within Sushi Go, like maybe the most complex action that you take.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a gateway game has to have a few of those because like it ramps up the complexity of actions that a player learns how to do. Because like when you're just starting board games, you might not know what it means to like draft an extra card. But then you think about things like Seven Wonders, where it's like you can either draft a card or you can put it under your wonder or you can sell it. It's like the fact that Sushi Go has a thing that slightly changes that, I think just makes it like a good ramp up training wheels. But then, yeah, Azul just has very concise drafting. Like, not even the fact that it's from a pool, but just, like, you still have to think about how other players will take what you don't take. But yeah, maybe it's a bit more open because you don't have to expect things.
Yeah, the dynamic of the dual pool that Azul has.
Dual pool.
Elevates it beyond something that's just, like that one game you mentioned, Matthew, where it's about you can pick 1 to 3 and the goal of the game is to not pick the last one. It's that whole dynamic of the dual pool where there's the smaller pools on the outside that you can take partially from that will contribute to a larger pool on the inside. But then there's the drawback of being the first one to take from the larger pool. It makes for some interesting thought processes, some thinking of like what your opponents are going to want to do and what you want to set up for yourself.
But one thing Azul has over Sushi Go is all of the things that you're passing up are always visible, and all the things your opponents can pick are visible, which helps with the memory issues that new players can often have with drafting. Like, you know, you could pass a hand and be like, oh, wait, what did I even pass? Stuff like that. And it kind of ruins the point of trying to predict what your opponents will draft if you forget what you're going to pass them.
I see a reason to have both games in a collection.
They're similar but different niches.
I think both of them also still fit into the category where we played them with people who never played them before, and then they picked them up like immediately afterwards. So just to do a quick recap, what we have for our gateway games are code names as gateway game 0.05 level, the gateway-iest of gateway games. And then following that, we talked about, what was the one after that?
Well, let's see, we talked about Star Realms.
Yeah, that's right. Star Realms, which
is the deck builder.
We talked about Magic Maze, the cooperative game.
We talked about Lords of Waterdeep,
the worker placement game. And then we talked about Sushi Go and Azul.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. There's a few more I have listed down.
Okay.
So tile placement games are another one that like there's been a lot of gateway games over the years to fit the bill. I think so. Tile placement being like you get a tile, you place it on a board, and the position of it matters in like how it connects to other things. I like to think of it as like a lot of games that use dominoes kind of are similar, and it fits because I think the best gateway tile placement game is King Domino. And now I think, well,
when I was thinking of tile placement games, I was also kind of considering area control, but King Domino doesn't involve any area control. It's just,
right.
It's still a kind of a drafting game. But
sure,
yeah,
that's fair. Maybe King Domino's a bit too much like Azul, because they are pretty similar when you get down to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think King Domino definitely has this idea of like, it's more about spatial positioning and reasoning than Azul.
Yeah.
Like how you lay out your board is much different than Azul and much more dynamic. And I think that's personally what I thought of like the main aspect of tile placement is.
Mm-hmm. You might, like, maybe we could consider it like a, like, I don't know, what's, maybe the term is like a tableau builder or you know, like a garden builder, or I don't know how you classify it. It's kind of like where each player has their own plot of land that they take certain actions to develop, and it's the forethought that's important in these kinds of games.
Like maybe not area control, but like area perfection, area development,
area management. I like development.
Area management, yeah.
Development, yeah. And management. Yeah. And King, sure, Domino is a really great gateway game for that kind of game where there's indirect conflict with your opponents when it comes to the way that you develop your spaces, but each player's space is independent from one another, which is a good thing for a gateway game, because, you know, on top of having to manage the whole acquisition part of things, having to also work around what your opponents play out and where, and I mean, you know, a game like that could turn into a situation where people get locked out of the game because they kind of work themselves into a corner.
Yeah.
But in King Domino, it's all like your own device. There's no way for your opponents to mess up your plans, other than taking a piece away from you, which is, you know, just, I mean, that's a part of gaming, I guess.
Yeah, it's a part of life.
It's part of life, is pieces taken away from you.
In previously, a lot of people would consider Carcassonne to be the definitive tile placement gateway game. Mm-hmm. And I think Carcassonne's a good one for also sort of an area control style. But I think nowadays Carcassonne is kind of weird with how its points work.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, Carcassonne, the way, maybe it's a little bit too, just a little too heavy.
It's not too heavy, but when you compare it to what there is nowadays, like King Domino or Azul, mm-hmm, it is much more complex by at least one magnitude.
It might be kind of like in Carcassonne, you can't really predict accurately how many points your actions are going to be worth. Whereas in King Domino, it's very clear to see, like, and to explain King Domino, it's a game where you draft these tiles, which are it's like 1-by-2 ratio, and they fit together in a big square, and you score points by connecting terrains of the same type with buildings or stars on them or something.
Something like that. It's coins, like, whatever.
Yeah, you like multiply the treasures, coins by the number of connected
crowns.
You multiply the number of crowns in a connected area by the number of spaces in the connected area. Or the number of tiles used to make the connected area. Either way, I mean, in King Domino, the way you earn points is you multiply this by this, and so you want to collect a lot of crowns, and you want to connect all of your territories of the same type together. Versus in Carcassonne, you say like, okay, I built this thing and it's got a road and it's got a field and it's got a part of a city, but I don't know exactly where I should be putting my guys for this. Like, should it go in the city?
It's that Carcassonne's a bit too unintuitive.
Yeah.
Especially with farmers.
Oh man. Farmers can be crazy. Farmers be crazy.
Yeah. Farmers be crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Farmers be crazy. New tagline for the podcast. So, King Domino has been added to the list. So, go over it once more. Codenames, Star Realms, Magic Maze, Lords of Waterdeep, Azul, Sushi Go, King Domino. That makes 7 games. So, if we were to stop at that 7 number, which we set for ourselves for some reason, at the beginning of our podcast, and that would be it. But Matthew, do you have any more games to add to this?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to quickly mention that one thing that we haven't really gone over is Take That or Press Your Luck games.
Mm-hmm.
Press Your Luck being, you know, games where it's all about randomness and assessing whether the randomness is worth it. And Take That being about directly like attacking a player and impacting a player because only one person can win. Mm-hmm. And it's a zero-sum game. That's a very loose definition. But I think Exploding Kittens is actually a really good gateway game.
Okay.
So, what? You seemed unsure.
I've played Exploding Kittens. Well, maybe it's just my bias because I have another violent kitten-themed game think is superior to Exploding Kittens. And actually, it may still fit into this Take That kind of gameplay. Although it doesn't involve knocking players out of the game.
Yeah. So Exploding Kittens, for one thing, I've found is a pretty approachable party game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it doesn't have too much of a hard player count cap.
No, I think it's modular and there's a maximum, but the maximum's kind of high for the game itself. Yeah. Because you have to, it's like you have the two copies of that one card that let you prevent yourself the defuse or whatever.
Yeah.
And so the game is limited by the number of copies of that you have. But I think other than that, the game is playable with a variant number of characters, players.
But so, I mean, the game's approachable, which is something worth mentioning. But like, as far as Take That games go, a lot of them start to be either like very unfun because people can gang up on people, or they start to be more complex as it goes. Hmm. I think this hits a very good level of like low complexity, and also you can't really gang up on people during the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of weird to say, and I think the big part is that there's just, I can't think of a better game for like this sort of category.
Hmm. So would you consider Kittens in the Blender to be a type of Take That game?
I would say so, but I wouldn't say it's a Press Your Luck game.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Exploding Kittens sort of has a Press Your Luck aspect.
Okay.
About like when to play cards or when to just draw or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also helps a lot. And I mean, it's not as much as a game like Dungeon Roll or something where you're really pressing your luck and, you know, literally rolling dice. But again, like as far as a gateway game goes that I think is like essential, I think this makes more sense. Maybe I'm stretching myself more for the sake of filling out the list completely.
I would say maybe it fits as a press your luck game, but I would rather include Kittens in a Blender. Maybe I'm just biased to Kittens in a Blender, but I find it to be just a way more entertaining game than Exploding Kittens. And I mean, Exploding Kittens also has some mature themes to it, so if you want to
only if you get the mature version.
Oh, is that right? I forget.
Yeah,
I guess I've only played the mature version.
There's safe for work and not safe for work.
Oh, okay, there you go. And I prefer Kittens in a Blender. I mean, just in general, I find the humor of Kittens in a Blender to be way more subtle, which is something that I just dig a whole lot. I also the term that you've recently liked to start bringing up a lot is narrative equity. And
yeah.
Kittens in a Blender is a great game to build this narrative equity storyline.
Sure, yeah.
With all these cute kittens. They all have
a
different
name. You get
attached
to your kittens.
Oh yeah. The game is only improved by getting attached to these kittens. It's improved to a great effect.
You
when
know,
you see
you know
them blend,
what I might
but you
say
don't actually see them blend. What?
Kittens in a Blender might be a lot better if you like were to automatically just get the extra player count added.
Yeah, it is only four players, the original version of the game. And that's kind of what takes it out of being a party game, at least.
Right. I think it feels kind of cramped normally with four players, but I would think of it much higher if you just had like six players or six decks instead of that or whatever.
Mm.
But that's a weird line to draw, I will admit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give you the benefit here.
Okay, so I will put Exploding Kittens on here on this list of gateway games as a press or luck game.
Okay.
But I want Kittens in the Blender to be.
Sure.
I mean, you can hear the narrative equity that I built for it. I'm not even thinking of just the game Kittens in the Blender. I'm thinking of all those precious kitties with all those precious names who I blended over the years.
Yeah. Let's see. So from there, everything else I have is... Oh, I was going to say one more thing, which is Love Letter.
Okay.
We haven't touched on a deduction game yet. We've touched about games that have deduction, but not one that is so deep in deduction.
Right.
Love Letter is extremely simple to learn in my experience. And like it was between this and Citadels. But I think by Love Letter removing a level of game abstraction or like gamification,
mm-hmm.
I think it works better as a gateway game.
Oh yeah, regardless of like the genre, Love Letter is way more of a gateway game than Citadels is. Citadels is a pretty complicated game.
Sure, yeah.
Though I mean, I've played it with people who were maybe relatively new to gaming and were kind of able to pick up on Citadels, but yeah, Love Letter,
yeah,
far and above is a gateway game, you know, to its core.
Love Letter is one of what I would consider the old guard, which is traditional gateway games that still fit really well into that socket.
And do you want to just give a short description of what Love Letter is?
Love Letter is a game where each player is trying to vie for a princess's affection, I think. And so, like, you play cards with different numbers, 1 through 9, I want to say, 1 through 8. And each one has their own effects that allow you to prevent other people from winning or win yourself or counter other things or whatever. And it's very much about trying to guess what the opponents have in their hand.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it about having the highest card in your hand?
Yeah, it's about having the highest card in your hand at the end of the round,
mm-hmm.
Or playing a card that lets you just win without that.
Yeah, you can knock people out of the round.
Yeah, but obviously that's where all the guessing comes in and the bluffing.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that's a pretty good list for a list of gateway games. Codenames, Star Realms, Magic Maze, Lords of Waterdeep, Azul, Sushi Go, King Domino, Exploding Kittens, Kittens in a Blender, and Love Letter.
Okay.
Covers a little bit of everything, introduces you to some concepts and mechanics that will very much make a lot of games make sense later on.
Mm-hmm. I want to say that obviously... This is our own list. This isn't a definitive yes/no. This is something that I at least wanted to do for the sake of discussion. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting topic that doesn't get brought up much. And if you have any additions or changes, then, you know, tweet at us or comment or whatever. We'd love to hear it.
I'm looking at this list and we don't have area control.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So Catan, I guess.
Well, I mean, if you want, you could take out King Domino and instead put Tigris and Euphrates.
Would you consider Tigris and Euphrates to be more gateway than Catan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Catan has some really weird resource management and all that.
Let's put in Tigris and Euphrates. Although the planning around war, or the calculations around war.
That's kind of fair.
And the whole thing that you can like chain wars together in Tigris and Euphrates can make it a little complicated there. I do like that in Tigris and Euphrates, the goal is to have because there's like four kinds of resources and you want your lowest count of one kind of resource to be the highest number it can be. Like you want all of your resources to be around the same number and you want them to be high. Because it's at the end of the game, every player looks at all their resources. They determine which resources they have the least of, and whoever has the most points of their least common resources, the winner. And I like that part of it, in that it's just a game about having a well-rounded strategy.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe that's something to think about. Maybe we'll think about it and we'll mention it in a future episode this month.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, area control is kind of, I mean, for the same reasons that we said that King Domino had some advantages over an area control game, is because everyone is vying for the same territories. And there's, there's indirect conflict in some games, there's direct conflict in other games, and it can all get very complicated.
Here's a question.
Sure.
Is Ticket to Ride an area control game?
Ah, we got it. It's Ticket to Ride. That's absolutely an area control game.
True.
It's got some amount of press your luck to it as well. In that there's the fact that you have to save up a lot over a number of turns to score really large territory areas. And
or that the tickets themselves are worth good amount of points, but you don't want to have too many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just to finish real quick, it was that if you save up too much, if you wait too long, somebody might steal away your plans from you. But there you go. Ticket to Ride is the area control game.
That's like the oldest, well, maybe not oldest, but the most common gateway game that still seems to be worth its salt in gateway game gold.
Yeah, it holds up. What can we say? Catan, though, not so much. It just got a lot of press.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to go over one more time the list of gateway games. Codenames is Gateway Game 0.5. It is a party game that makes you think and could bring you into a lot of other games. Star Realms, Deck Builder. Magic Maze is cooperative. Lords of Waterdeep has worker placement. Azul is a pool drafting game. Sushi Go is a card drafting game. King Domino it has some drafting elements, but it's about planning ahead in your own personal plot of land. Exploding Kittens is Press Your Luck. Kittens in a Blender is Take That. Love Letter has deduction, and Ticket to Ride is area control. These are the list of gateway games that we have developed for you, our listeners. That's 11 games total there.
You know what? You can go ahead of everything. You can go ahead and cut out Exploding Kittens, because Ticket to Ride has the same amount of Press Your Luck.
Yeah,
plus, which is weird to say, but
plus I hate Exploding Kit.
But that rounds it out to a nice even
10. And it feels so good to hit backspace on my keyboard. Ten. Forget we ever even talked about whatever that game was about maiming kittens.
Wait, and just what? Keep. I mean, we talked about that one.
I know, but forget the other one. Just keep Kittens in a Blender in your hearts and minds this holiday season.
In the box.
Keep your color kittens in the box. Keep the other player's kittens in the blender, and then hit blend. Party games. And we've talked about a couple games that kind of constitute as party games, like Codenames and Magic Maze. Both excellent party games with some interesting elements to them. But where would you want to go from there when talking about party games?
So thinking about party games, a lot of the best party games are like low on thinking rules. Yeah. So the rules are there to facilitate like discussion or fun or stuff like that. It's right, not like you have to focus on the rule itself.
Yeah, the rules tell you to do something, and then the gameplay is that doing something, and doing something is very interesting and fun.
Yeah. So I think one thing I want to bring up is call and response party games. Mm-hmm. Is sort of what I've called the apples to apples Cards Against Humanity mm-hmm. style, where a question is posed in the form of a prompt or something, and then you put your response and something happens with them. I think the best one is the Game of Things.
The Game of Things.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people like Cards Against Humanity, and that's fine. But I think the Game of Things has an edge, which is that it allows player input. So like Cards Against Humanity, you're always using pre-made cards for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
The Game of Things, you write down on a piece of paper what your response is.
Maximum player input.
And yeah, I think like those where you're able to write down something are way better for call and response games.
Mm-hmm.
This might be a personal thing, though.
Well, I know that in like games like Cards Against Humanity and Apples to Apples, the blank cards always seem to be kind of the most exciting cards. But they also seem to like if you can't really match the level, like especially in Cards Against Humanity, like match the level that the writers of the game, who are professional writers, achieved in their responses, then it kind of can fall flat sometimes. But I guess in Game of Things, everyone gets their shot.
And the goal isn't even necessarily to be funny.
True.
It's just being funny is a side effect.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's bad to be funny because then people will know it was yours, because the game is about guessing who wrote what response.
Here's an idea. So there's a lot of times where the top funny man can win every call and response game.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this a lot with Jackbox games.
Oh, yeah. The top funny man. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the most funny person in the room will always win. But in Things, if you are the most funny, people are more likely to think it's you.
Yeah, you give yourself away. You lose every
game. So it balances the funny. It's a level playing funny field.
I'd like to play the Game of Things so much that everyone is trying to be the least funny that they can be.
Trying to be as bland as they can be.
Exactly, because because nobody wants to be the funny man.
In a way, being dry is its own funny.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well,
I'm laughing at the thought of it. So
yeah, sure.
Super Fight's always good. It's in the realm of debate games. There's debate games where you just draw a card that has two topics on it and you must each debate one of those topics. And then there's like not really a debate game, but a pitch kind of game where you have to pitch something to a group and then have your pitch be the best pitch out of everyone's pitch.
I just call those improv games because they're set up kind of like improv things like Whose Line.
Kind of. Although I don't know. I don't know if I'd say that because, I mean, Game of Things, you have to improvise what your answer is.
Well, sure.
I just call them debate or pitch games. Yeah. Because that's what you're doing. You're either debating. In Super Fight is both of them, because in Super Fight, you kind of get a chance to pitch your character and why you think they would win. And then there's also a period of debating, counterpoints from your opponents who think that your point and how you would win is wrong. They would actually win in a fight. Right. And I just think Super Fight's the most entertaining, exciting version of that kind of game.
I think Super Fight is really good for people that are really into, like, I don't know, geeky stuff. Because, I mean, there's movie characters, there's historical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of, like, not quite general knowledge stuff. But at the same time, I don't know, I mean...
I mean, there's like biblical stuff and fairy tale stuff. I think Super Fight covers enough bases and has a broad enough selection of cards that anyone can play it. If you're, you know, really into the stuff, then you'll probably be better at arguing the sides of, you know, comic book characters and stuff like that, having an idea of exactly what they've been depicted as being capable of. But as a party game, not as a serious debate game. I mean, if you're asking someone to debate what something can do or what something is, I've seen people have a whole bunch of trouble like coming up with an idea. I played a game called The Game of Things where you draw
not
The Game of Things. The Big Idea. The Big Idea.
Yeah.
Where you draw a couple things and then you have to pitch a product that is inspired by those cards that you drew. That's like prompted by those cards. Yeah. And, you know, I've seen people just like not be able to do that at all. But then they jump into a game of Super Fight and they're all over it. They know exactly what to say. They know exactly what they want to say, at least, when it comes to their turn to debate their
Super
side.
Super Fight is the ultimate narrative equity game.
Yeah.
All about imagining a fight and how it would play out.
Yeah, for some reason, just imagining these characters and their abilities is just easier to I don't know, digest and form an opinion on.
Yeah. I will say Superfight is a great game to house rule with.
Mm-hmm.
Or like make up new modes to play. This is something, a bit of a tangent here. I love party video games that allow you to have custom game modes or edit the rules a little.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like why Halo is such a good party game, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But Superfight's a good game to do that with tabletop-wise.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jackbox earlier, and that one's just...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a bunch of collections of games.
We talk about it on our Good Stuffs episodes a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
it kind of toes the line between tabletop and video game.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, I mean,
it's got like Cnit interactivity. And I mean, there's no board to it. There's no physical parts. It all takes place on computers, but
the concepts are a lot like board game concepts.
Yeah, you
like Quiplash is just Cards Against Humanity.
Right.
In a way, but because of the digital nature, it allows you to input your own stuff and have it moderated by a computer and all that.
Yeah.
So there's definitely benefits to it. Speaking of concepts, concept.
Yeah, I was going to say that was probably the last game I wanted to mention in the party game section. Just a fun game alternative communication.
Yeah.
And we did a whole episode on concept, but the basic is that you work with a partner, you get a word. It's kind of like charades where you get a thing that you're trying to get other people to guess, but instead of acting it out, you have a board filled with these little tiny icons and illustrations, and you have to distribute cubes and pawns on the illustrations, which the other players are supposed to kind of mentally combine and interpret in order to get what you're trying to get them to guess.
Yeah. And this isn't one that I would recommend to everybody, but I do think it's definitely worth being on the radar if you're mm-hmm. looking for party games.
Mm-hmm.
I have one more to mention, which is Werewords.
Oh, yeah. How could I forget?
This has been like one of our new favorite party games.
Yeah, instant classic with us.
Super approachable.
Yeah, it's so Werewolf, the game, is a game of a deduction where one player is a werewolf and they're trying to win by eliminating the people in the town, and the town don't know who the werewolf is and they're trying to suss them out or guess them out, and every time they're wrong, it gets harder for them. Now, where that kind of game, I guess, can be I find those kinds of games at least a little difficult because you have to do a lot of arguing in those games. You have to be assertive in those games. Werewords adds this layer of 20 questions to the game, where rather than trying to eliminate townspeople, there is a word that the townspeople are trying to guess through a game of 20 questions, and the werewolf is trying to prevent them from guessing by misleading and derailing the game of 20 questions. But the whole thing is about not being obvious, because the werewolf knows the word, so they can sort of formulate ways of avoiding the word and preventing the townspeople from guessing. But there's also a seer, a player who knows the word and is trying to help the townspeople, but without making it obvious that they are a seer. So it's this game of 20 questions with this extra layer of trying to be subtle about what you're trying to do in the game of 20 questions. And it just ends up being a very interesting, if anything, it's just 20 questions, which isn't a terrible game, I guess.
Yeah.
But then it just adds a whole bunch of layers to it, which makes it very interesting. And, so you already know the rules, and then you get into it, and then you just have to slightly modify your understanding of the rules to get really into this game.
Yeah.
All right. So those party game recommendations again. Where did we start on party games?
Game of Things.
Beyond Codenames and Magic Maze, Game of Things, and then Super Fight. There was another call and response game. That was Things. And then Concept. I'm going out of order.
Yeah.
What was before Concept?
We briefly touched on the Jackbox games.
Jackbox games, right. And then... And then the last game we talked about, man, I have bad short-term memory.
Werewords.
In reverse order, Werewords, Concept, Jackbox Games.
Jackbox Party Pack
Jackbox
games,
Party yeah. Pack Games, yeah. Super Fight, et cetera, et cetera. I forget the games.
Okay.
It's late, folks. And so, yeah, listen, just rewind about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes to remember the ones that we forgot. And without anything else to talk about, that will be the end of our Gateway Games / Party Games retrospective episode.
Pretty much, yeah.
The new canon.
The new canon.
So
that's a good album name.
Oh, and I'll go over the Gateway Games one more time, just to be safe.
Wow.
There are Codenames, Star Realms, Magic Mage, Lords of Waterdeep, Azul, Sushi Go, King Domino, Kittens in a Blender, Love Letter, and Ticket to Ride is the list of Gateway Games. And that will be the end of our episode. Thank you very much for listening.
You know, I realized we could give it a really clickbaity top 10 Gateway Games as of 2018 title.
We could. Maybe we will.
A reason.
The listener will know when they see this episode on their podcast streams.
Speaking of
podcast streams?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can follow us on any podcasting app you want.
Ah, very good.
Wherever you listen to podcasts.
Exactly.
Leave comments, leave ratings. You can let us know what you think about it and give us your opinions.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to hear feedback from, you know, whoever listens to us. And you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at BG Broscast.
Mm-hmm. You can go to bgbcast.com where we post all our episodes and organize them with tags. If you want to find episodes on any of the games that we talked about that we've done episodes on, which was over half of them, at least.
Yeah, pretty much.
Just to go through the list of Gateway games we came up with. Yes, Codenames. No, Star Realms. No, Magic Maze. Yes, Lords of Waterdeep. That was recently. Yes, Azul. No, Sushi Go. I don't think we've done King Domino yet. Did we do King Domino? Maybe we did.
Anyways.
I don't know. You go check it out. But we definitely did Ticket to Ride. And we did a number of the Gateway games. We did a number of the party games. We even did an episode on party games itself. So yeah, go check out our back catalog for games that you might be curious to hear our thoughts about. Stay tuned for when we eventually talk about the games that we haven't talked about from these lists.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they all deserve at least a full episode to discuss their qualities. You can also go to our friend Chris Roger and Jason's website, entertainthegeeky.com, to check out their podcast. They're our friends. We're happy to rep them. We used to tell you to go there to get our merch, but we have just set up a new place to get merch because we are having some issues. But we won't get into the details of those issues. We will just say that if you would like to get your very own Board Game Bros merch, you can go to www.tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. That's tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. And that is where you can get your very own Board Game Bros t-shirt, long sleeve shirt, crew neck sweater, or hoodie.
Yeah, we finally have those.
Yes, and tpublic will not mess around. You order that, it will come to you, guaranteed. So if you want to get your Board Game Bros merch and rep the podcast, please check out TeePublic at that.
And you can
address.
Bet that I will have a link to that on the Twitter page as well and on the Facebook page.
Exactly. Yep. You can find the links there, or you could just go to tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. That's it for my plugs. Matthew, what are your plugs?
I stream at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream mainly weekdays at 11 a.m. Central U.S. time. I play a lot of competitive games. I play RPGs. I speedrun. I do a mixture of things, what they call a variety. And I also have a Discord where you can chat to me or Jeff or whoever in there and, you know, talk about all the stuff that we like to do and the stuff you like to do.
Mm-hmm. All right, so check out the stream, check out the Discord, check out our merch, our website, our social media, our podcast stream. That's it for this episode of Board Game Bros. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.